Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Chief, you know, there's two things in this world I hate to miss. One's a Lakers game and the other's Rich Rossi Live. You gotta be cuckoo to miss this show, you know what I mean, pal? And wait till you get a load of what Rich is gonna talk about today.
Today on Richard Rossi Live, we're gonna talk about something that I know a lot of you have tuned into this show in the past for the series we've done on cults, people that have been in cults and recovered from cults. We're honored today to have a lovely author, Lucretia Bingham, talk about her new book, which is entitled Absolute Cornelia. It's a coming-of-age story about a girl growing up in a moralistic cult, gets into a relationship with her dad, with a handsome young man in the cult, and it's something I relate to a lot. The cult in this novel is very moralistic, and as many of you may know, my wife Sherry and I met and married in 1984 while students at Liberty University, which was, the chancellor was Jerry Falwell, founder of the Moral Majority. So reading this novel, for me, I took a little bit more time reading this than I read most novels because it caused me to reflect and relate to it so much and think about it and journal about my own experience. We signed a pledge. It was called the Liberty Way. It was anything but liberty. It was a lot of moralistic rules. You couldn't go to a movie theater. You couldn't listen to rock music. You couldn't single date the opposite sex. You know, it was just on and on and on. But this novel, Absolute Cornelia, is now available wherever books are sold, and we're going to have the honor of speaking with its author in about 20 seconds. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back to talk about Absolute Cornelia. Lucretia Bingham is the author, and she is now on line one to talk to us about it. Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live, and I am honored to have Lucretia Bingham with us. Welcome, Lucretia.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I'm honored to be talking about it with you.
I loved your novel. I know that it's one of those novels that's quite personal to you, and writing this has been quite a journey, and congratulations on finally getting there and putting this out. This was an exorcism, perhaps, of some of the demons of your own background with the cult and different things you went through. How did you finally write it? What was it like to write something this personal, this cathartic?
Well, as we were talking about briefly before the show, as a child, when you are in the confines of a cult and you're growing up in it, you don't question things quite as much as you might do when you're an adult. And if you're a child that's being bounced around, as I was, my mother lived in kind of an island shack, and then my brother and I would be catapulted, you know, across to the United States to go live in the cult. And we were just told how we had to behave, and we told, you know, and it was very, very strict, absolute moral standards. So it took me many years to kind of come to grips with how it had affected me as a child. The part of what I write about in the book, I think, and it is true for many members of people who've been a part of a cult, there's a wonderful comfort and safety in being in a cult because all your questions are answered for you. The leaders say, this is the way you do it, and if you follow our rules, everything's going to be fine, and if you don't follow our rules, you know, all hell will break loose. So for a child who's kind of trying to make sense of a very bewildering world, for a while, it feels safe. And that certainly was true for me. It took me many years. I had lots of other stories to tell, too. And this was one in particular because I really wanted to talk about a child trying to come to grips with who her father had been and why he chose to be in a cult and love God more than he did his own kids.
Yeah, that's quite a profound point, Lucretia, about the security the cult offers. And that all the answers are black and white, and
exactly.
we choose that prison in a sense. And it seems like I remember hearing a few psychiatrists that analyzed this talking about how there's phases of spiritual growth, and they talk about like the immature phases is like fundamentalism and moralism, where everything's black and white. But as a person evolves and grows in life, there's more mystery to God, there's more questions, there's safety to doubt. And I really
yeah.
like this character of Cornelia because she did at some point, not to give away too many spoilers, but at some point she did get more involved in the cult in the novel about maybe 60% of the way into the story. But one thing I do like about her is she did challenge it. She did think critically. She did confront the dark side. There was one leader in the cult who's a sexual predator. And she did, even though she was under that indoctrination and as a young woman eventually subjects to some extent, it seems like she was full of piss and vinegar, as my grandpa would say, and that she did question it. She didn't swallow it hook, line, and sinker. She was a bit of a troublemaker and a free thinker, even in the early phases, it seems.
Absolutely, she was. And one of the things I wanted to write about is the evolution of all of us have an inner voice that I think if we listen to the truth for ourselves and our relationship to the world and whatever divine spirits there are, exists in all of us. And so in a sense, because she's an observer as a young girl, there are many good things about the cult. It's not all bad. And so when she begins to trust that she can listen to parts of it and question other parts of it is when she truly begins to come to some kind of peace within herself. And
yes. So there were some good things you mentioned. I don't want to get you in any trouble because, so let me give the disclaimer that this is a novel, everybody, and no, any resemblance to persons living or dead is, coincidental, et cetera, et cetera. But I will say, and I don't know if you can say it, reminded me of the Moral Rearmament Oxford group, and if some of you don't know, this group did influence 12 Steps of Recovery, which I've been in 12 Step Recovery, and so it was very interesting to me because some of those slogans and sayings from the 12 Step groups keep popping up in this story.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head because that was the group that my father was in when I was growing up. It was called Moral Rearmament, and it was founded by a man named Frank Bookman, who, for those of you who are in 12-step programs, he influenced Bill W., and that's a lot of where many of the precepts of the 12-step programs have come from and has touched many, many millions of people worldwide. So that was all the good stuff that came out of it.
Yes. That's where my mind went, Lucretia, is I thought it was so interesting because here's obviously a very toxic, controlling, cultish group, and yet some of the principles have helped addicts now all these years later, and it's really interesting, the mix of the good and bad with something like this, isn't it?
Well, it is. And one of the things that I think is true of all cults is that they may start off with a really wonderful message. But unfortunately, people in power tend to be drawn to power positions, not always for the best of reasons. And so even if they've started off with a good sense of this is a good thing and it's a good cause, if power goes to their head, it can subvert them. And then they used to say absolute power corrupts. Power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Mm. And so that's part of what I wanted to write about is that you can have one leader in a group who is really toxic and a sexual predator, and other people who still are not that way and are not evil. And they can coexist side by side, which is a fascinating juxtaposition.
It's there's a thing in the recovery movement, a saying that I've heard in the meetings, which is something along the lines of not being diverted. I think it's in the traditions, the 12 traditions of AA, something about not being diverted by power, prestige, property, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And your story shows how they really glommed on to Cornelia's father. And by the way, if you're just tuning in, the book is Absolute Cornelia, a great new coming-of-age novel. But they glom on to her father because he has money, and made me think of the scripture where Jesus warned of the Pharisees who devour widows' houses and look for people with money to get their money for their religious cause.
And that really is true of many cults. They really do prey on the wealthy who keep their funding going. I think one of the reasons the 12-step programs have worked as well as they have is that there is a system of fellowship rather than leadership.
Mm.
And if the leadership becomes corrupt, it's very hard to have fellowship continue. You know, there is no one person in power. And when you go to 12-step meetings, it's just everybody.
It seemed like AA has gleaned a lot of the good from this group. It's just hitting me now that I want to, after this show, this link's good for replay in perpetuity, but we did a series of shows on people recovering from cults and many different cult groups, and as a resource to help heal people that have been through that experience. But I just realized I want to post this link on some of those recovering from cults websites also with my other shows, because I think our discussion is going to be helpful to people. Now, if I recall, the actress Glenn Close was raised in this same group. And for those of you that are like me, old enough to be baby boomers, I'm what you call a Scooby-Doo baby boomer. I used to do consulting about baby boomers, and we said there was the howdy-doody baby boomers that were kids in the 50s. But I was a Scooby-Doo baby boomer in the 60s. And I remember this song, Up, Up With People, You See Them Wherever You Go. And it was I think, the Moral Rearmament group. And I believe Glenn Close even was one of their singers.
And she was. She was involved in the very early stages of Up With People, and her parents were in Moral Rearmament for many years.
Mm-hmm.
So I met her quite often when I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
She, I'm sure, had a very similar experience. As a matter of fact, I've read interviews with her, and her experiences, I think, mirrored mine a great deal. One of the odd things about being a member of this particular cult, and what I wanted to write about in Absolute Cornelia, was how strange it is for a child to be one of, you know, many thousands of adults and just a few children. And that's luckily it's my nature to be an observer and a writer. So for a small child going through this experience, for me, it was just great fodder. You know, even at the time, I knew this is unusual. You know, I knew I was not having a normal experience.
Yeah, talk about a lot of characters for your work that you could turn into gold in this novel.
And one of the great gifts of being able to write about it years later is that, you know, I really am creating these characters out of, you know, the inspiration comes from real life, but the characters were definitely made up and, you know, lots of things happen that never happened to me as a child, but could have.
Well, not to give away the magicians, you know, they say never ask a magician their secrets, but did you find yourself as a writer doing conflation where a character might conflate several toxic, you know, memories of toxic religious leaders, for example, or, you know, so that you don't have like 100 characters, did you find yourself, you know, memories morphing into a character, even though you were drawing from several different people in your memory?
Absolutely, that's what happens. I mean, there's, you know, this blend of fact and fiction when you're a storyteller. I mean, I challenge almost any writer to write about something that is totally unfamiliar to them. At least in my mind, it's a springboard from your own experiences. And I have had experience with sexual predators in my life, but not in this particular cult that I grew up in. But nevertheless, I know it's possible because that kind of character, a cult can be a perfect breeding ground for somebody who's looking to control other people. And from everything I've read, sexual predation is much more about power than it is about sex. You know, it's about control and power.
I know that's true because I was at my doctor's office and they have the magazines out there, and they had a story on the Bill Cosby case of drugging women and allegedly molesting these different women, and he mentioned he had read the article, and I said to him that I it's so strange that I wouldn't want to be with somebody who wasn't consenting or didn't have a desire, and in a very clear mutuality. I said I could never relate to wanting that kind of a situation. And he said, well, the thing about it is this is a person that it's not about just the sex or the person. They want complete power over them. And we see this cult leader in your story. I don't want to give spoilers, but one thing I did reflect on was the fact that, and I won't be too specific because we want you all to read this book, Absolute Cornelia, but some of these leaders do not have the complete comeuppance in the story in a kind of a neat Hollywood ending. You always have all the bad guys, pay, so to speak, like the old Hays production code required, you'd always have the bad guy pay and be exposed and be punished severely. But then when I reflected upon it, your novel is actually more true to the way things can be in real life, as we've seen with the Me Too movement, where a lot of these people get away with it because they're elevated as a god in these cult groups.
Exactly. And true life does not always get, tied up in ribbons. And that's really what I wanted to write about, is a character who's trying to come to grips with ambiguity. And again, I don't want to be in a spoiler position, but there's a relationship toward the end of the book with her mother, where for those of us as children who may have had to deal with sexual predation, if you had parents who didn't believe that you'd been hurt or just wanted to sweep it under the carpet, that's an ambiguity you live with for the rest of your life, and a betrayal you live with for the rest of your life. And you, if you're going to be an evolved person, which I had a strong desire to believe, and I wanted to write about a child, Cornelia in this case, who really wants to survive everything despite the fact that it is ambiguous, that there is no particular happy ending, that she's thrown back on her own reserves and thrown back on her own inner voice to trust on. And that, to me, a more meaningful story for those of us, who weren't just given the happy ending. As it happens, personally, I have been given the happy ending, but it took a long time to get here. It was a long journey.
Yes, and that's a really great point about the mother. I think her name might have been Nevin. She obviously had her own insecurity and compared herself to Cornelia's beauty, and she was always she was a mentally and spiritually sick person, and so I've seen these kind of cases where a child has been the victim of a sexual assault, and the parent denies it because they are insecure and they think it will make people think they're a bad mother, they didn't protect their kid. They're instead of putting the child first, they look at it as a judgment on, I failed, and so they can't accept that, and so they're on the side of cover this up, don't talk about it, don't hang out the dirty laundry here.
You're exactly right. And I think that's, that's something I really wanted to write about, because I think that's something that many women have experienced. It's amazing in this last year or two with the Me Too movement coming out, how many women have confessed or admitted that this is something that happened to them and they could never talk about it. They were shamed by other, mainly women in their life, to keep quiet about it. Just don't make a scene. It'll all be okay. And, it's not okay.
And it seems like a re-injury when people begin to, just infer they're lying and question them. And we see that even in public hearings about people that make come forward. And it seems like you're raped all over again, for people to call you a liar.
Yes, exactly. and to doubt, and then you begin to doubt your own veracity, which is, you know, then that's a real spiritual death. That's a tough one to face.
This is a great novel, Absolute Cornelia. And if any of you want to send in a question to richardrossilive@gmail.com for Lucretia, you can do that or call in on the phone. Lucretia, we'll just be right back in about 10 seconds after a quick program identification. Okay, Lucretia?
All right.
We'll be right back with some more questions for Lucretia.
Okay, great.
You search, you probe, your mind, your spirit becomes weary. You find yourself on a journey to find a talk show, not just an ordinary talk show, but a Christian talk show, unlike anything the mind could fathom. Suddenly, your search comes to an end, for up ahead, there's a signpost, your next stop, the Rich Rossi Live Zone.
Well, welcome back to Richard Rossi Live Zone, and we're here with Lucretia Bingham, who has written a new novel, Absolute Cornelia. Where should we direct them to get it? Amazon, or is there a preferred site that you website you have that you'd like them to get it?
No, my website actually bounces over to Amazon. Amazon's probably the easiest, but
okay.
You know, in my area, a lot of the independent bookstores can order it, or some of them have it. So if you go into any bookstore and ask them to order it, they can do that too. But Amazon.com, they have both the print and Kindle available.
Oh, great. We have a question from Tanya. Tanya in Cleveland, Ohio, said that she started reading the book upon my recommendation, and there's a part in the book where you talk about guidance, where they would go away and pray for guidance, and she said this is similar to what happened to her in Pentecostal and Charismatic Christianity. And I've been in that world as well. In the charismatic Christian circles, there's a lot of times people will say, well, I have to hear from God about what to do about this and so. And so in the more extreme cases, you know, you have people like, oh, God, should I wear the blue dress this morning or should I wear the brown pantsuit, you know. And it's like you have to feel like you get a divine word from God to do anything. And yet, you know, part of the recovery you mentioned was Psalm 46:10 says, be still, know that I'm God. Part of the recovery is to be still, listen to your inner voice. As you said earlier, Cornelia learns more and more to trust that inner voice.
Yes.
Was this something that damaged you or your character? You think that pressure to always have to kind of, you know, like Moses on Mount Sinai, hear God from the burning bush for guidance like that?
For Cornelia, I believe that the truth comes from trusting her own inner voice, but where it gets difficult in the cult that she's in, and was for me as a child too, is that I think here again is the issue of leadership, because there would be circles of having guidance, and then we would have to read the guidance out loud, and then the leader would judge whether it seemed like the guidance came directly from God or not. So he became the arbiter, or she became the arbiter between God and the person receiving the guidance. So I think part of Cornelia's struggle is to learn to trust her own. There's at one point in the book where she asks her father, how do you know whether it really comes from, you know, a divine voice, or is it just my own selfishness asking for something? And I think in the cult that she grows up in, they basically used to say that you had to take your guidance and kind of look at all the different standards, the unselfishness, love, and to see if it met those requirements. And if it did, then it meant it was probably from a divine place.
Yes, it's kind of similar to what Tanya's referring to in these Pentecostal churches, because in those churches I would hear people wrestle with, I don't know if this, what these thoughts coming to me are God, Satan, or my flesh. Like they would go through this whole mental gymnastics over it like that,
yeah.
You know?
Well, we all know that, you know, Satan gets in there as much as he can. I mean, there's no doubt that You know, at one point in the book, her brother Nathan says to Cornelia, well, you know, why don't we just say that our guidance is to, you know, go to the circus and have fun.
Yeah, I love the brother character. He's a lot of fun.
And, you know, it's true. Why not just put down that you want a purple velvet dress for Christmas? Like, God says I have to have this.
Yeah. I had a friend that I nicknamed Hank Hyper Spiritual when I was, you know, really engrossed in some of these circles. And I called him Hank Hyper Spiritual because everything was like this spiritual thing he had to ask for guidance from. You know, I used to joke, like, you go to Denny's with Hank Hyper Spiritual and be like, Lord, do you want me to order the chicken fried steak or the ultimate omelet today? And he'd listen for a voice, you know. But it can make a person crazy to,
Yeah,
in fact, I've even seen, like, mental illness and schizophrenia where some of them are so focused that way they start hearing voices and really starting to lose it.
Well, and if you, you read a lot of the stories of the saints in centuries past, it's hard to tell whether they were really divine or schizophrenic. You're absolutely right. There's
yeah.
a confusion there. And I think all of us at some point have to decide which of the voices inside of us are the ones to listen to. You get better at it as you get older, I think.
You know, I know I'm circling back to this, but your book, your novel, and if you're tuning in, it's Absolute Cornelia is the novel available on Amazon, Lucretia Bingham. We talked about the power dynamics with these predators, but it made me think about how there is so much sex abuse and problems of this nature in religion, be it Protestant, Catholic, even a rabbi out here in L.A. got in trouble, same thing. And you know, there seems to be this repression that seems to make things worse, whether it's the priest can't marry or whether it's in this novel, there seemed to be a lot of sexual repression where it's kind of funny because she's attracted to this guy. And, you know, when you like somebody and you have romantic feelings and you're on the friendship side of the line, the big thing is, you know, who's going to be courageous enough to cross the line and how do you find out you like each other? But in this cult group, it comes through them confessing, oh, my God, I've sinned. I had an impure thought towards you. Well, I've had an impure thought towards you. I thought, well, this is probably the interesting way in the cult that they end up getting it on here, you know?
Yes, exactly. I mean, it is interesting how they have gone hand in hand with religion and repressed sexuality. I mean, there's nothing more exciting in a way than repressed sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you give in to licentiousness and passion at every moment, it can get kind of banal. But if you're constantly repressing it, it builds up this charge. And, you know, it's like an electric charge. What do you do with it? Well, some of them put it into giving fabulous speeches that change thousands of people. And others can't control it. It comes out in very strange, perverted ways.
I mean, there's so much. I don't want to take up your whole day, of course, but there's so much this book brought up for me. Another aspect was it seemed they were isolated, you know, off at the different properties and things like that. And as a young man myself, I related to this because after my father, who was bipolar, was hospitalized, I really turned to, through a neighbor, I got more and more into fundamentalist religious circles. And they would get us off and away at different church camps. You have no television or phones and things like that. And it seems like that whole thing was rife for Cornelia to be so isolated, for her to be indoctrinated, you know?
Totally. I think isolation is part of it. There's this build up in a cult of isolate you and then build you up and then kind of tear you down. So that, and in this case, the cult that I'm writing about in Absolute Cornelia, they also woo the rich people with wonderful meals and tell them how wonderful they are. And for some of these people who've never really been listened to before, who have a lonely existence, to have somebody really paying attention to them and really listening to them is very, very seductive. And then once they have you in their grips, then they do the starting to tear you down. And, you know, of course, the predation for to the rich and the people who just write endless checks to keep it going. It's a pretty fascinating subject. It really is.
Yeah, and the family really got sacrificed too in the story, which I relate to. When I went to some of those church camps, as I said, I remember one thing that really stands out to me was a family reunion, and it was one of my last chances to see my cousin Linda, who I love dearly. But the cultish groups pressured me that God wanted me to go away to the church camp. So I ended up missing a chance to be with cousins and family because I was off with these church people I barely knew. And then my cousin Linda died in a car wreck, and I've looked back on that and thought, you know, at the time, they're like, well, this is your family, and you have to, you know, scripture about, you know, the new family and the family of God and things like that. But, you know, I think, like, family is so important and such a barometer. It seems like, you know, ripping parents and children apart the way these cults do, it's one of the hallmarks that something's really amiss.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. And that, and Cornelia, when she first arrives at this conference, I mean, one of the most painful things for her is she thought she was going to spend time with her father, and instead suddenly he's whisked off to another part of the conference center, and her brother's whisked off to another part, and she's really alone. Mm. And that can be a terrifying experience for a child and a young adult or an adult to, you know, to be isolated and not have your family, and then these people telling you how to think and how to behave, and so you fall back into the safety of the rules because you're feeling so lost.
Mm.
And as I think I said earlier, for me, writing the book many years later, it's a wonderful thing to be able to look back on it and see what was good about it and to not be angry anymore. You know, for years I felt angry at God, and I think that's something that Cornelia struggles with in the book too. And I wanted to capture that feeling of a child going, why does my father, you know, appear to love God more than me? You know, that doesn't seem right. And so to be able to write a story about a little girl coming to grips with some of that, it's been great to do it from the vantage point of years distant.
Well, I appreciate it. I have to confess, I felt very angry at the father, C.W., at different points in the story. Very angry at him. But your
book
helped.
Well, I think you're supposed to. I mean, because
he's
behaving is pretty despicable at times. Yeah.
Yeah. But your book has helped me to identify these phases in my own life. When I started to realize the damage of some of the legalistic religious groups that indoctrinated me as a young man, and I've had to work on recovering from that. There's a retreat I went on. Dr. Marlene Winnell, who wrote a book, Leaving the Fold, Recovering from Toxic Religion, does these retreats. And in the retreat, she did talk about how the young people that are most damaged by this type of experience are the ones that are very, very sincere and go into it 1,000% and are very sensitive. And that, you know, the person that can distance and glean the good and spit out the bones isn't quite as damaged if they're more lukewarm about it as the one that goes all in. And when we're young, we do go all in. But you helped me to identify that my earlier anger about this is subsiding, because now I have some good friendships with people that I met in those circles, and I don't feel that same sting of anger anymore about it, you know. And so you really helped me with that. I'm very grateful for your book.
Well, thank you, and I'm so touched that you felt that way, because when you do write a book, it's a lonely endeavor, and you send the book out into the void and hope that it will touch other people in the ways that you've been talking about, but you never know. So it's actually a wonderful thing to hear you say that. Thank you.
Well, I'm your fanboy, Lucretia, and and I'm really grateful you came on the show today. I could exhaust you talking on and on about this, but our time has flown by. Like Einstein said, time is relative, and when you talk with a very interesting person and author like yourself, you know, 30 minutes goes by like 3 minutes. And if you talk to a boring person, the 30 minutes can seem like 3 hours.
Well, anytime you want to have me back on, just let me know, and I would love to come back on. And it was great talking to you.
Okay, great. And how can people keep up with you, like any, you know, book signing appearances and things like that?
I have a strong presence on social media. I'm on Instagram as Lucretia WB. I have a Facebook page called Lucretia Bingham at the Talcott House. And on both of those pages, I will let people know about events or books that are coming out. As a matter of fact, I'm hoping that this book does well enough because the second half of Cornelia's story is already written and ready to go. So,
oh, great. Yeah, the sequel.
Yep. So it's all set to go, but we, you know, we got to get this one marketed and out there, and the more people who read it, the better it is for all of us, but most of all me, I guess. In that case, I'm definitely interested in hopefully touching, as you know, and people in the same way that you just said you were.
I just found you on Facebook. It's Lucretia WB.
Yeah.
And I see you there. Yeah. You look lovely with your husband in a white hat.
That's actually my personal page. I mean, that one I also will be posting things, but Lucretia Bingham at the Talcott House is another page. One's a business page and the other's personal, but I do post on both. So, and Lucretia WB is my handle on both Instagram and Facebook.
I just found your page too at the Talcott House. There we go.
Yep.
And it has the same picture of you that is in the inside back of your book.
Yes, exactly. So I'm easy to find, and I would love to hear from everybody, you know, thoughts, questions. I, you know, love to be able to answer anything or respond to people in any way that I can.
Anyway, well, I am so grateful that I found out about you through through Diane Nine, your literary agent, who turns me on to great books like this.
Fabulous. Again, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, God bless you. And once again, thank you for writing this book, and thank you for coming on the show today.
You're most welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And thank you to all of you for listening today to Richard Rossi Live. And we have some exciting shows coming up. A friend of mine, Rico Simonini, he has made a film that delves into Frank Sinatra's affair, marriage with Ava Gardner, one of the most passionate love affairs of all time. And Frank wrote and sang a song out of his despondency of breaking up with Ava called "I'm a Fool to Want You." If you ever listen to the recording of Frank singing that, he's on the edge of suicide and had to go into the hospital. I mean, it's just so poignant. But my friend Rico, he is an actor I've worked with, and he has co-written and made a film called Frank and Ava, and he'll be coming on our next show to talk about the film Frank and Ava. So mark your calendars for that, and December 11th, 3 p.m. Pacific time. And thank you all for listening, and again, the book we discussed today is Absolute Cornelia, Lucretia Bingham. God bless you all, and as our notable guest said today, keep listening to that inner voice, that still small voice inside you.